Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guests this morning are Charles Dance and Mike Vogel, the stars of Sci-Fi Channel's epic TV miniseries event, Childhood's End. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you, Summer.
I have to ask, this is such a classic sci-fi story written by Sir Arthur C. Clarke, published in 1953. Had either of you guys read the story or familiar with the story before you were cast?
I hadn't read it. I read it when I was offered the job. Talking to people who did know a lot more about science fiction than I did, then it became apparent that what an important figure Arthur C. Clarke was, is, and that we were all collectively taking on quite a large responsibility here.
Yeah, I was aware of Arthur C. Clarke through things like Space Odyssey 2001, but after being offered the job and kind of doing my research, realizing that this work, that Childhood's End, was actually the more favored and cherished piece of literature among sci-fi fans. I believe I heard that Kubrick, it was actually Kubrick's favorite of the two, but it was thought to be unadaptable. So
yeah, I was one of those people who never thought this could come to TV, but I am pleased that technology has progressed to the point where it can be done now. I'm glad it wasn't done like 20 years ago, but I can't tell you. I've been looking forward to this ever since I heard they said they were making it. Charles, what approach did you take to playing Karellen? No spoilers about Karellen's appearance.
Well, obviously I can't give you any clues about Karellen's appearance, as you say, but there were a particular set of challenges that I'd never had to face before, but I thought I would embrace them. He's a kind of godlike character, but strangely, there's a kind of naivety, because he is, when you first meet Karellen, then he announces himself as the supervisor for Earth. He is seen by people on Earth as a superior being, but then it becomes apparent that he is only a servant, really. He is a facilitator, as he says. There is a superior being. He's a pretty complex character, obviously. He's not human, but he has embraced humanity so that he can attempt to understand humanity and attempt to sort out the mess that human beings are making of the planet. So, I just approached it as I try to do with everything I do, really, which is to try to make a character believable. In this particular character, there's, in my emotional catalogue, which is what we all have as actors, we have a kind of library of experience, and you think, well, okay, I know what that's like, because I remember that experience. So you pull out this bit and you put that into your work. But with this character, there's not very much that I could draw on. So I was dependent upon, one, Arthur C. Clarke's book, and two, Matthew Graham's rather skillful adaptation of it. And I can only hope that I've pulled it off.
Yes, the performances and the writing for this have impressed me greatly, and I must say the first time I heard you speak as Karellen, I'm like, okay, that's the voice I've had in my head for 25 years. Bravo!
Oh, wow, wow, good, thank you.
Now, Mike, Ricky is the emissary, the voice, the representative on Earth of the overlords. What did you embrace to bring both the humanity and the responsibility that Ricky had to the screen?
Well, for me, it wasn't it wasn't too much of a stretch. They refer to him as the blue collar prophet, my upbringing is very much that sort of a background, and if I compare it to my journey and throughout my acting career, is I've long struggled with taking myself seriously as an actor because of that blue collar background. People suddenly care about your opinion. I've often looked at that and said, well, what entitles me to somehow having a weightier opinion on this, that, or the other thing? Why is no one putting a microphone in my father's face back home in Philadelphia? I understand a lot of what Ricky went through. He looked at it and said, I'm a farmer, okay? I'm not whoever you think I am, I'm not the guy. And to which Carellan responds, that's exactly why you are the guy. You're a uniter. You're not soiled as in the original book, as I'm sure you've read, Ricky Stormgren is a 60-year-old head of the UN from Finland. He is a dyed-in-the-wool politician, and I think it's kind of, in light of our circumstances in the world today, making him a farmer is much more interesting and believable a journey.
Yes, there are a number of changes, which me and some of my co-hosts will discuss later from the book, but what has been adapted, I have thoroughly enjoyed, and both of your performances so far have been impressive to me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Selma.
What did you most look forward to in bringing these characters to life? Because, like I said, this is a classic story, and it's the first time it's been adapted.
Well, I think the sheer expanse of this story. We're two characters in what is a huge cast of characters. Osi and all these other guys playing these characters. There are storylines that don't even cross one another throughout this entire project. I mean, I shot my bit, and there's entire other parts of other storylines that pick up where mine leaves off, and so it's a hugely ambitious project. But I think for me the ideas were what drew me to it. The questions that it asks us about ourselves, and Arthur C. Clarke's foresight writing this in 1953, dealing with war and famine and economic instability, all of those things, and fast forward to 2015, we're in exactly the same place, sadly, and possibly even worse. So I think now is a great time to do something like this.
I can only agree, Thomas.
Well, the headiness of the underlying story has always fascinated me, how someone shows up from the stars to shepherd humanity into the stars, only that journey is going to be very, very different than anyone ever expected. I am pleased that the production has been so, so entertaining so far, and thank you guys for your performances.
Thank you.
Thank you, Summer, very much.
All right. That's Charles Dance and Mike Vogel, the stars of Sci-Fi Channel's Childhood's End, airing December 14th, 15th, and 16th on Sci-Fi Channel, 8 p.m. each night. Please tune in. It is well worth the watch. Thank you for your time today, guys.
Absolutely.
Pleasure, Selma. Thank you.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
There's a little superhero in all of us. Listen to Krypton Radio every day, and we'll help you find yours.
Hi, welcome to more Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and with me this segment is executive producer, writer Matthew Graham, whose credits include Doctor Who, also the creator of the excellent TV series Life on Mars and Ashes to Ashes. But this year he is bringing us a beloved science fiction classic, Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End. Welcome to the show, Matthew.
Lovely to be here. Lovely to talk to you.
I can't tell you how excited and scared I was when I found out that Sci-Fi Channel was doing Childhood's End, because I've been hoping for a television or movie adaptation of this story for decades. And I was like, how are they going to tackle adapting the story to a modern audience? Are they going to do it right? Because historically speaking, Sci-Fi Channel's miniseries have been gems. I have absolutely adored like 99% of the miniseries, which is why I was glad it was a limited series. But there are some very, very heady concepts in this book that are not easy to portray for today's television audience. So kudos to you for tackling that Hydra.
and I mean, it. You know, you can't go into something like this with. You have a respect for the novel. I love the novel. I came to it as a kid. I love Arthur C. Clarke. But you, maybe it's something cultural in the country that I grew up in the UK, because we're used to adapting big novels and great novels. And if I may say, novels even greater than Childhood's End.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what you get is a kind of a reverence that must not tie you down, so that you can't be overly reverential. Because if you're overly reverential, you can be completely reverential when you're reading the book as a reader, but when you're adapting it, you have to ask the question you would ask of any story: is this going to work on the screen? Do I need to change anything to make it work on the screen? And if I do need to change it, how do I change it in a way that preserves the intent of the author? Now, the problem you have is that the moment you change it, you are changing the intent of the author. That, again, you have to accept, and you have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, or you just put the book in a big dark box, and you stick the box in a tree, and you say, it's never be touched or opened by human beings. And I don't think anyone wants that. And I think we all know that whatever we do with the adaptation, it doesn't take one jot away from the book. It's our representation and interpretation of the book and the themes. So really, I kind of just sat down and said, I want to preserve these themes. I want all the big moments in the book to be in the show. I want Karelin to look like the Karelin that I see in my head when I read the book. I want the ending of the book to be the same, and the ending of the miniseries to be the same as the ending of the book. It really boiled down to accessibility. What's our entry point? And I've said this before to people about the book, which is Clarke wrote a book in a time when novelists wrote novels to be novels. They didn't write novels to be turned into movies. And today, a lot of writers write books that are designed to not only be movies, but franchises. So he didn't think about it being adapted, I don't think, particularly. I think he just thought about the ideas he wanted to explore. And as a result, I think his characters tend to be ciphers for the ideas. Now, the ideas are amazing, and they're brilliant. And the characters in the book don't really need to be anything more than messengers for the ideas. So that can't work on a TV show. Just can't. It's not working in a movie either. And so my take was to find a way to emotionalize, to make emotional the ideas in the book, and to see whether or not I could create characters who had embodied something of the characters that were in the book, but were their own, but could reflect a modern day audience, and the audience could at least feel as though, yeah, I get this character. So I didn't really feel that the head of the United Nations was something you or I would know. I mean, I don't think you know what the head of the United Nations thinks about anything when he's at home. And I'm not entirely sure. I think that the head of the United Nations is a very interesting sort of starting point for a modern show. Back then it was, because they were in an age when politicians were seen as the best of us. But I think today we feel we're a bit more world weary and world-wise. And I just felt that it was a kind of more interesting to take a regular person and to see them, see the light, that God, the light of God shine on the shepherd boy rather than shine on the emperor. It just seemed like a something a godlike alien would do to me. And then it creates an interesting dialogue because the farmer wants to know why he's been chosen. And in the Bible, you know, when people like that, when the Rickies of the Bible say to God, why me? God said, because it's my decision, because I'm God. You know, they don't sit down and say, well, because this, they just say, it's me, I've chosen you. And you don't need to question it, it's just, I've chosen you. And I felt that was my way into the relationship between Karelin and Ricky. So that was one of the big changes that I know fans are terrified of, and probably some of them are very angry about. But I truly believe, for a big audience, that I had to do something like that. Otherwise, the only other way of doing it was to have Anthony Hopkins in front of a curtain with the book, reading it to us from the TV.
Now, that could have been fun. That could have been fun.
It's not a bad idea.
Yeah, have Anthony Hopkins sit in a chair, kind of Masterpiece Theater-like, and just read us the book.
Yeah! No, I like it. Now I'm warming to it.
But I would actually love to talk to people who are angry about some of the character changes, because the character changes, the connection with the characters, and doing what Clark didn't and pulling those same characters through the entire story, I think that works. I think that works is you have Ricky is younger. He's going through some of the same things most of the planet is his age, you know, give or take 5 years.
Yep.
And they are going through the same changes, adapting to the Overlord's new rules that he is. Mm-hmm. And so you connect that to the audience by pulling in what he's feeling, what he's going through. But you have this added level of he's the voice that's talking to humanity from the Overlords, and everybody wants to be around him every second to find out what he knows. And even if he doesn't know it, they still want to know what he knows.
Well, it's also very tragic because Moses died before he saw the Promised Land.
Mm-hmm.
Noah ended up drunk in a vineyard. You know, the Old Testament is full of prophets who are used and then discarded. And I found that sort of trajectory very, very interesting, which is why I created the trajectory for Ricky that I did, which again, I think some people will find very harsh and they'll say, that's not what the Overlords would do. But ultimately, there's a lot more in the book that suggests the Overlords are harsh. At times.
Oh,
it's in the book. There's things in the book that suggest that if you really cross them and defy them, they might kill you.
Yes,
if they really thought you were a threat to their plan.
I was wondering if the bullfighting matches, the bullfighting tournament in Spain was going to be in the show, and it wasn't. I was like, I wonder how they were going to adapt that event. And you sort of had that event adapted in what happened with Milo, the little boy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the bullfighting thing we all loved, but there were two things. Firstly, the book was written in the 50s when Ernest Hemingway was writing Death in the Afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Bullfighting was very prevalent. It was a thing. It was a thing. We all recognized it as a global thing. I know bullfighting still goes on, but it really doesn't feel like a 21st century pastime. Secondly, I just couldn't see how a bull... I was like, it's only been 36 hours since an alien race had descended upon the Earth, and they're still going ahead with a bullfight. Not because it's a bullfight, but who would be going ahead with any of these things, and who would be bothering to go to an arena to watch it? We're going to have the series, and we kind of set the World Series up, and so I know these aliens have arrived, but I think we should just carry on and have the World Series, and everyone would go to the stadium and get excited. I just don't think they would. So, dare I say it, I didn't do that. I loved the book, but it was a scene designed to make a point. it doesn't work in a film or a TV show, because you kind of wonder what all these people are doing watching a bullfight when there's an alien spaceship hovering 100 miles away over Madrid. So, and plus it's anachronistic to our time. So it was a shame to lose, because it's an iconic scene, but it was just one of those sort of tough decisions you have to take when you're, and it would have been very expensive to do,
yeah.
And it might have been something that we ended up cutting out because it didn't work. That was the reason behind that.
Yeah, no, I was looking forward to a big classic scene where, because the Overlord said there will be no violence, no war, anything like that happens,
yeah.
We will step in. And I was kind of looking forward to an epic stepping in and squashing of things, but contrasting that with the sudden humanity on two sides of different conflicts all over the world at the same time, just embracing each other, saying, you know, hey, this is petty, it doesn't matter anymore. I thought that was poignant. But eventually you want to see the Overlords quashing something, going, no, these are the new rules. We mean it. Here's why. Boom. But it works. It still works.
Yeah. Well, thank you. But I mean, originally we did have stuff in the script. You actually saw an army being felled by an eclipse and they were terrified. It's very expensive. And really what it would have been nice to have seen it. I think in a movie we would have done it. If we'd had a few million more in the budget, maybe we would have done it. But I think ultimately it wasn't as necessary as it seemed, because, as you say, you're kind of keeping the focus then on your small number of characters. So you're watching characters, watching the news, listening to the radio, hearing of these extraordinary events all around the world. And I think in some ways it does the job dramatically that you need it to do. But you know, I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, if we'd had the money to do a big end of a war sequence, we would have probably done it.
Okay. Would having an 8-hour miniseries have given you more room to explore a couple of those themes a little deeper? Because the one thing that I don't think came across clearly until I watched parts 2 and parts 3 a second time were what was going on with the children and why Milo was so interested. It didn't come across quite as deeply as the way it was told in the book.
Right. Well, I'll take that. Yeah. I mean, you know, we had a lot to do, a lot going on. You try to get all these beats to work and to play, as you hope to do it justice. And yeah, I don't have an answer to that except to say we tried and maybe we didn't quite fully succeed on that. But, I'm very proud of how the mystery of the children does evolve, in particular in part 3. And I like some of the unknowingness, the ambiguity of what's really happening. I tried very hard to keep a sense of us knowing something about what's going on, but not knowing everything. I hoped that would make it seem scarier.
The uncertainty of it really came across in the Gregsons. Their absolute terror at their children becoming something different, something they couldn't understand. And then you saw like quick glimpses of other parents around the world when Karellen made the announcement, which I'm not going to spoil here just yet. but the Gregson's despair, for lack of a better word, came across very, very powerfully. I'm like, wow, yeah, you feel that.
Well, it's very strong in the book, isn't it? I remember those scenes in the book. I mean, the early scenes, again, without spoilers or anything, but the early scenes where the Gregsons had their baby and their young son, and you really feel that they're trying so hard to carve a normal life for themselves, full of sort of optimism. They're quite optimistic people. They're quite jolly. And they can't... You just know something's changing and they have no power to stop it. I think that's very sad.
Yeah, the I think the one thing I was looking forward to seeing scenes of the children playing with the moon. But
I know we wanted to do it too. I'm sorry we couldn't do it. It cost so much money.
I know we can lament. We can lament and say, "Hey, Sci-Fi John, can you put out a graphic novel where we get?"
I originally had it. I had it. I had a version of the scene. Again, spoilers and everything, but I had a version of the scene where the bit where she's in her bedroom with the mobile. Mm-hmm. Well, that was going to be a preempt of an even grander moment that you know from the book. And we had it up until almost the last minute. We had it almost there, but we had to make we've got to make some cuts here to the budget because it's so ambitious what we were trying to do. And we had a fantastic budget, but it was, but we were trying to make a $300 million movie. So, eventually you have to just say, well, that one's going to have to go. But I'm with you. I'd love to have seen that.
And the end where Milo is chronicling what's happening as the children finally, I guess, transform, and the leaving isn't quite as obvious, but what happens to Earth when they do leave, that was rather poignant. And the way, it's slightly different. It's actually very different, where Milo says, "Don't forget us, keep something of us. We don't deserve to be forgotten."
Yeah.
That, okay, I will admit that part brought a little tear to my eye, especially when I started playing.
Well, again, I knew I was taking a step away from Clark at that point. I understand I was, but I figured he owed me that one because I tried to do everything right for him. I tried to make that ending the uncompromising ending of the book, and I just figured, oh, what harm can it do, to hang on to one little tiny thing? But I'm sure some people will hate the fact that I've done that. But I'm a sentimentalist. I just wanted to keep a little thing in the end.
Well, I know that some people. When was it? Like 90 or 92? When Clark rewrote Childhood's End to make the space race bigger? To it's not just about getting into space, getting to the moon, it's about getting to Mars and getting beyond our solar system.
Yeah.
So, that was updated, and I honestly don't remember if there was any controversy about that. So updating it again for, more technology.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. Aliens come in and go, "You're about to experience interstellar travel. We have to put the brakes on you because you're not ready."
Yeah. You're not ready, and you'll never be.
Yeah.
And that was the thing about
the novel. Like, the novel didn't say, "You're not ready, we're going to slow you down for 100 years. It's like, you in your current form as humanity will never be ready for the rigors of space travel.
Yeah.
You can't go into space, but your you're leaving behind a legacy that will, even though you yourselves won't be here for it." And the first time I read that,
right,
I went, "Whoa, wow, okay,
I know,
wow,
I know." It is a wow moment, one of many wow moments in the book. Yes. I mean, again, you're also trying to bring a drama to the screen for people who haven't read the book, who are going to be more, who are going to outnumber the people who have read the book. So although you kind of want to find a version of the story that honors, as much as you can, honors Clark, but at the same time, there's a lot in there that's going to make people go, "Holy moly." When we were doing the sound mix for episode one, when Karellen finally reveals himself at the end of night one, the sound mixer hadn't read the book, and he was, he fell off his chair. He was like, "Oh my God, he looks like that." we were so used to it. We were all sitting around going, "Yeah, that's right, yeah." Why? Does that work? We were like, "Does that work?" He was like, "Oh my God, it's mind-blowing. What are they going to do when they..." And we just got so used to it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to people who haven't read the book yet seeing this and going, "Wait, what?" And then checking out the book. Because... And I think it was... I wish Milo had had a chance to talk about, because there's like one line in there where he explains why everybody throughout the history of humanity had been so afraid of the image of what the overlords look like. And I think he only mentioned it as being they've been here before, so there's fear transfers down. But in the book, it was put of more of a foretelling, a premonition that this image means the end of humanity as we have evolved on this planet, and the next version of humanity
I tried to get both across there. There was actually a second scene that we did film about that, but it was decided that the one thing would encompass that Milo has about that, encompass the idea. Yeah, I love all that. I love the idea that it's embedded in us, that that's why we make them into the epitome of the scariest thing we can imagine, because we ultimately know they're going to come and change everything. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful idea.
And for me, it's sort of a precursor, because it's a collective image that we all have, and it's the one thing we pass on to the children as the children become a greater collective. You know, they are a conscious collective. We are an unconscious collective. And I always loved the way that parallel came across in the story for me. And the mention of it by Milo, I was like, okay, good. They got it in there. I love it.
Well, also for me, the very path that I fought very hard for, because there was all sorts of conversation about whether to have it or not, is the end of episode one when Karellen appears with the children, mm-hmm. and I said that's essential to me, because he knows what we don't yet know about the children, and I think that stuff is really really important. It's very hard with a book that's so full of great ideas. It's very, very hard to keep track of every single motif, every single philosophy, every single concept that Clark has got going on. You can't, because it's just, there are so many of them. And that's, you know, you always miss, and I know people say to me, oh, when's the moment where this happened? Where's the moment? You try to get everything in, but again, unless you have Anthony Hopkins reading the book, it's very, very difficult to get every single nuance and idea across. You just hope that you can get the broad, you hope to get like 50% of it across, you know, and then you think, well, if I can get 70% of it across, then that's pretty good going, you know.
Well, I would like to thank you profusely, profoundly, as eloquently as I can, for tackling this in such a compelling way. Like I said, I was a big fan of the original Life on Mars, and what you did here deserves, really, really deserves to be seen and appreciated for the homage to the book that it is, and just embrace the differences. Because like I said, for the Sci-Fi Channel, I love some of the stuff they did. I'm an old school Battlestar Galactica fan. I absolutely adored what they did with the reboot. And this is right in line with that compelling storytelling that I have come to trust from Sci-Fi Channel again. There's a couple of years in there where they were disappointing, but right now they're hitting all sorts of marks, and I'm loving every minute of it. And I'm glad they gave you this chance to bring this story to the screen for us.
Great. Well, thank you. It's a privilege to be able to do it as well, and it means a lot. Coming from someone like yourself who understands the book and is aware of the challenges of adapting it. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. That is Childhood's End. The miniseries begins Monday, December 14th, 8 p.m. Sci-Fi Channel, three nights in a row. Watch it. And you know what? I think I'm going to email Sci-Fi Channel and say, I would like this on DVD with extended director's cut and commentary, pretty please. That's what I'll do. For Christmas, I will get that petition going. How about that?
Okay, that sounds great. You're on.
All right. Thank you very much, Matthew.
No problem.
We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi Movie Review. I'm Noah Richman.
And I'm Darren Gulzig.
Today we are talking about Macbeth, the Michael Fassbender starring as Macbeth. And I guess this would be the Justin Kurzel, is that how you pronounce it?
Justin Kurzel, yeah.
Version.
I would think that sounds right.
Yeah. So, of course, you don't usually hear a lot of Shakespeare being reviewed on Slice of Sci-Fi, but this is definitely one that would be of genre interest because it does star Magneto from the X-Men. It does star a cast of actors that have been in various genre films. We had, let's see, Macduff was from Prometheus.
Well, Marion, let me see if I get this name right, of course. It's Marion Cotillard. I'm sorry if I mispronounced, but she was in a couple movies. She's an actress from France, of course. You know, it was Inception. That's why I remember her from, so.
So that's right. So, yeah, we've got the actress from Inception.
It's Lady Macbeth.
Sean Harris, who, again, from Prometheus. And then, of course, the director himself, who is going to be directing the upcoming Assassin's Creed video game to movie adaptation. So, Macbeth, what are your thoughts on this film? Let's start first just strictly from a genre perspective. We've just stated why this would be of interest. Of course, the play itself is a Shakespeare play with witches and battle scenes and various things that would appeal to a genre audience. Forgetting, first off, whether you think it's a good film overall or not, what do you think about it as a film for genre fans? What was your reaction?
Boy, that's a tough one. I think for genre fans, they might find something that appeals to them. But again, traditional sci-fi fans also may be turned off by its, you know, static type imagery in the actual movie. So, you know, that's a preference thing. That's a good point. I mean, I'm not sure.
Right.
You know? How do you feel about that? I mean, do you think?
Yeah, and so for myself, I certainly think the fact that they're incorporating the battle scenes, that they're having this creepy atmosphere throughout, I would think that it has all the elements to appeal to genre fans, is how I would put it. On the other hand, I'm not sure if the way it puts itself together would be as much of interest. And then I guess maybe from here I'm going to go off from speaking to genre fans to just speaking about the film in general. I thought that it really had all the elements of an intriguing and interesting film. It's nice that you finally get a Macbeth with good, you know, it's like watching, you're almost like watching Braveheart, but more downbeat. And the costumes are right out of something like, of course, Game of Thrones or any number of current popular historic epics, Tudors and Borgias and whatnot. And the way it's shot, it really is you know, has beautiful framing and use of color and sound. The soundtrack is really impressive. But somehow the whole thing falls flat.
Yeah.
And I've seen other Shakespeare adaptations that, you know, they do Shakespeare, they adapt the dialogue, they you know, they keep the dialogue intact, and yet somehow the whole thing breathes with like a current, a contemporary life. This one, it just, there's something very stilted about it.
Yeah, I think that's point right on. Gorgeous visually. I felt like there's some scenes that were just so emotionally compelling with this placement, the composition, and the music was so haunting that I almost feel compelled to buy the music from the movie. It's that good. But overall, to maintain the interest of a moviegoer, is it going to be good enough for that? And I just don't know if it is, because it requires a certain amount of patience to watch it develop. And, you know, if anybody's familiar with Macbeth, there could be nice sequences made, you know, put to the big screen, and that just didn't really happen. It felt like they lifted, you know, the play right off the stage and just put it up and shot video, and they actually made the film from the stage itself. So it just felt like, you know, scene one, let's get off the stage and set up the next stage, you know, and it just felt like it was a Broadway play, and it didn't really feel like a cinematic experience, only, you know, except for the gorgeous visuals. I mean, the color palettes, this constant red that coursed throughout the entire film reminded you of what was Macbeth's inner torment. You know, he's got this hate, rage, and he has this destiny of greatness, and yet he's not meant for it. It's just all these visuals that actually, after the movie, I just felt really bothered by it, and the next day I woke up, I still was thinking about the movie, so I guess that stands for something, you know.
Right.
But I don't know that I'll probably watch it again, if only to appreciate the visual choices the director made, and obviously to listen to the music, because it was pretty good.
Right. Yeah, so Macbeth, all the right elements in there for the makings of a really good Shakespeare adaptation, but I've seen three Macbeth films now, and I've seen the Orson Welles, I've seen the Roman Polanski, and of the three, this turned out to be my least favorite, even though the elements in it were the best. The sets, the costumes, the battle scenes, but it just fell flat for me. It just felt very stilted, and I struggled to stay awake.
Well, the Michael's performances were pretty impressive. I think, if anything, it makes me excited to know that he is going to be a part of the Assassin's Creed film coming up in the future. So, I mean, if anything, I just watching
Michael. I'm sorry, Michael Fassbender.
Yeah, he's playing. Yeah, but if anything, watching him wear this crown and feeling that he fit the part perfectly, a part of me wishes he was in Game of Thrones, because he's just such a powerful image in that role. You know, of course, we're not used to seeing him sport a beard and everything, but he seemed to handle that character, you know, the power of it, and
yeah.
did it pretty well. And so I think the performances in the movie, they're really solid.
Yeah.
You know, and so I don't, like I said, there's a lot to like about it, but ultimately it just doesn't, you know, maintain that pace that you would want in a movie release.
Yeah, everything's right about it except the tempo. It's like going to a concert where you have a really skilled musician who can do everything except somehow his timing's off.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Anyway, that's our thoughts about Macbeth, and thank you for listening to Slice of Sci-Fi.
Later.
Hey, Summer, it's Mary from Massachusetts. I only ever called in once to the Babylon podcast at the very end, but I listened all those years and loved it, and I just recently listened to the September 26th show for Slice of Sci-Fi podcast, where you were going over Doctor Who favorites and so on. And it was so nice to hear Tim Callender's voice again. Just wanted to say, nice to hear him and you together again. I've been missing the Babylon podcast. So. I'm looking forward to hearing your selections for your choices of the best episodes for The Doctor. And I'll keep listening. Thanks so much, Summer. Bye.
Oh, thank you, Mary. I'm happy to announce that we have Tim on the show quite a bit. Last week's episode, Slice of Sci-Fi episode 745, featured a discussion about Ultima, which is a space opera that we all know that Tim loves, space opera, just as much as I do. And he and Jill and I talked Ultima. So check out last week's episode. Actually, if you're listening to this, you might already have. So, but thank you for the kind comments. All of us enjoyed our time on the Babylon podcast talking about Babylon 5, still one of my all-time favorite TV series. Also, Slice of Sci-Fi TV, not dead, just changed. We have some video reviews out there by Noah and Darren that have repopulated, revitalized the podcast, so to speak. And I'm trying to figure out how to get these interviews properly formatted. Because, yeah, the interview, part of the interview you heard today with Charles Dance and Mike Vogel, I have video of that. Can't get it working. Anyway. Oh, here's one tidbit. Slice fans and Kick-Ass Mystic Ninjas fans might find of interest. I recently was a guest host on the Dragon Reel podcast. We talked about the movie Willow. You can go listen to that over at dragonreel.com. What else do we have in other news? Star Wars coming up next week. We hope to have something interesting, something different for everyone discussing Star Wars. And we have Death Scribe 2015. The performances were this past week, December 7th in Chicago. And as I anticipated, the winning short was Earwigs. If you go back and listen to that episode, it was the one written by Joe Zettelmaier and directed by Sarah Sevigny. So she defended her winning title. She is now the winning director for Death Scribe 2 years in a row, and Joe gets to take home the bloody axe. Well done, guys. Well done. And yeah, I should say when that audio recording is available for people to listen to, I will happily direct everybody to it, because just reading that script gave me the screaming heebie-jeebies. So I can't wait to hear what those effects sound like being performed. It should be delicious. But that will do it for this week's episode of Slice of Sci-Fi. If you have your own questions or comments, please feel free to call them in. That number is 602-635-6976. Or you can record a comment of your own and email it to summer@sliceofscifi.com. Please leave us a review on iTunes. The reviews let people know what kind of show to expect. Things are a lot different now than they were in years past, even from before the year-long hiatus. But we are back in action, doing everything old school, I guess. New school? Old school? We've switched things up, and we're still putting out the show. That's what counts, right? Check us out on Twitter, @SliceOfSciFi, @SliceOfSciFiTV. Check us out on Facebook, on Google+, Slice of Sci-Fi. And of course, come to the website, SliceOfSciFi.com. We have added a few features for user interaction. If you don't agree with some of the reviews our people put out, feel free to leave your own. Yes, you can comment on the reviews that are existing on the website. If somebody gave something 2 stars and you think it deserved 3.5, let us know. You can do that. Just click the little button and say, no, you guys got this one wrong. Or if we gave something a 4 or 5 stars and you agree, leave your own 4 or 5 stars and say, hey, you got this one right. Either way, we're here for you to listen to your voice, to add your voice to the opinions that we have, because that's what geeks do. We have fun arguing with each other about nitpicky things like how good a movie is, how bad a TV show is. You know the drill. Thank you all for your donations, keeping this show and the websites, actually all the shows and all the websites running. People who are supporting through Patreon, thank you. Thank you very much. If you want to help contribute, you can go to patreon.com/sliceofscifi and pledge to help support us in what we're doing here. Your patronage helps support Slice of Sci-Fi, Slice TV, Writers After Dark, and the return of Kick-Ass Mystic Ninjas. So again, thank you all for that. Many thanks to Tim Callender again for the artwork that's gracing the websites and the podcast episodes. And of course to my good friends Sci-Fried, the geek rock band with so much heart and soul. Check them out, sci-friedband.com. If you like the theme music you hear here, they have plenty more where that came from. And for Mary, that includes an awesome cover of Metallica's For Whom the Bell Tolls, only it's called For Whom Babylon Tolls. So Yeah, go check that one out. That's a favorite of mine, too. But again, that will do it. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.